Hello. Welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, August 27th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the list of names in the obituaries. There are four names today. George Contreras, Jr., no age given, of Phoenix. Ira Amand Fulton, 94, of Chandler. Lonnie Lease, 68, of Tucson. And Frances Ann Ortega, 68, of Phoenix. Sunsounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals just listed. And now we'll turn our attention to the business section of the paper. It looks like there's three articles on the business page. At the top of the page, the article is entitled, Target Removes Offensive Clown Costume. It's written by Jessica Gein for the USA Today. Target apologized for a Halloween circus clown costume that critics said appeared to conjure blackface and 19th century minstrel shows. The costume, sold as the Kids Glows Under Blacklight Circus Clown Halloween Costume, prompted a social media backlash. Target said in a statement, quote, "As a company, we know we got this wrong. We are deeply sorry. The costume is offensive and should never have been part of our assortment," unquote. Target said it has pulled a costume that was sold as part of its seasonal Hide and Eek boutique brand. It was the latest in a series of reputational blows that have undercut sales. From its handling of its Pride collection in 2023, to its diversity, equity, and inclusion policies after President Donald Trump returned to the White House. Target joined a broad corporate retreat after Trump issued a series of executive orders aimed at eliminating illegal DEI, thus backtracking on efforts to boost representation of black employees and support black-owned suppliers, saying it needed to stay in step with, quote, "the evolving external landscape," unquote. Well, that policy reversal was widely viewed as a betrayal by black Americans who had embraced the retail giant and fueled its fortunes. Some shoppers expressed new disappointment in the Minneapolis-based retailer that they once affectionately called Target. One user said on Threads, quote, "So, Target, you really don't have anyone left in Minneapolis to say, hey, that's racist? Y'all cut DEI, and now you've got a minstrel clown costume for kids on your website?" Unquote. Target, which has seen two straight resurgent quarters under new CEO Michael Fiddleke, a pledge to do better. And the company said in their statement, quote, "We know this is especially hurtful for our black guest, team members, and partners. Removing the costume is an important first step, and the company is looking closely at how this happened and what needs to change to ensure that this won't happen again," unquote. Target has little room for error, Brett Hulslein, who is an analyst at Morningstar, told Reuters. And that was the article, Target Removes Offensive Clown Costume. Our second article, More U.S. Employers Expected to Drop GLP-1s. This was written by Amina Niasse, that's N-I-A-S-S-E, from the Reuters News Group out of New York. About 14% of employers in the United States have already dropped or they plan to drop the GLP-1 drugs in 2027, as companies see rising healthcare costs, according to a survey released on August 25th by the Business Group on Health. Healthcare costs are set to increase 9.2% if employers do not make changes to manage those costs in 2027. That raise was up from 8.5% in 2026. Two-thirds of employers surveyed said they saw rising utilization of the drugs. Now, GLP-1 weight loss drugs, such as Novo Nordisk Wegovy and Eli Lilly's Zepbound and Foundayo, help people lose weight by mimicking a hormone that keeps the stomach feeling full. Zepbound and Wegovy can cost hundreds of dollars per month or more, according to list prices on manufacturer websites. Ellen Kelsey, who's president of the Business Group on Health, Ellen said, quote, "This represents an unfortunate new reality for employers who now face growing difficulty in budgeting and forecasting. It is a call to take a more disruptive approach and rethink how to deliver value and improved health outcomes," unquote. The Business Group on Health is an organization that advocates for employer health policy and benefit solutions. The group has seen consecutive increases in expected cost since 2022. Kelsey said the increased cost for hospitals, pharmacy costs, and policy changes have all contributed to rising spending on health care by employers. The cost pressure has pushed more employers to encourage use of cheaper biosimilars or drop coverage for complex or specialty drugs and explore alternative pharmacy arrangements. Pharmacy costs made up 25% of employers' health care spending and are expected to rise by 12% in 2027, unchanged from the prior year. The share of employers covering GLP-1 weight loss drugs dropped from 72% in 2025 to 60% in 2026. Employers surveyed ranged from those employing fewer than 5,000 to over 100,000 people. By condition, cancer was the most frequently cited condition driving healthcare spending, with 70% of firms naming it as their most acute cost driver, up from 58% in 2025. Musculoskeletal and cardiovascular conditions followed as top drivers for companies. Business Group on Health said the treatments for conditions involve more complex therapies. And that was the article, More U.S. Employers Expected to Drop GLP-1s. Our third article from the business page, Maine Island Getaways, top list of expensive towns. Massachusetts. That's MA. MA Island Getaways, top list of expensive towns. This was written by Daniel DeVice for the USA Today. Two island getaways off the coast of Massachusetts rank as the nation's most expensive small towns. Nantucket and Vineyard Haven have the priciest homes among all U.S. towns, according to a new report from the personal finance site LendingTree. The median home cost $1.6 million in Nantucket and $1.2 million in Vineyard Haven. The nation's most expensive towns defy common wisdom about living cost, which suggests that towns are generally cheaper than big cities. A typical home costs more in Nantucket than in San Jose, California, which LendingTree tags as the nation's priciest large metropolitan area. Matt Schultz is the chief consumer finance analyst at LendingTree. Matt said, quote, "There are definitely small towns that are as expensive as the most expensive big cities in this country, and in many cases, it is not driven by the people who live there," unquote. Many of the priciest towns rank as prime vacation spots, with populations that swell in the summer or the winter with visitors seeking sand and surf or snow. They often sit near roaring rivers or majestic mountains. And definitions of town vary widely. For this analysis, LendingTree looked at places with populations between 10,000 and 50,000. The ranking excludes expensive suburbs like Scarsdale, New York, that's a part of a larger metropolitan area. Nantucket, Massachusetts, with a median home value of $1.6 million. Nantucket is the most expensive town in the United States. The island getaway swells in population from 14,000 to 80,000 or more in July and August. More than half of the homes are seasonal. Then we've got Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts, and this town, part of Martha's Vineyard, is the second most expensive U.S. town with a median home value of $1.2 million. It is another island retreat with more than half of the homes put to seasonal use. Next up is Jackson, Wyoming. The third most expensive U.S. town is better known as Jackson Hole, the name of the valley where it sits. Once populated by Native Americans, Jackson is known today for its ski resorts. Its median home is worth $1.1 million. Next up is Breckenridge, Colorado. Another skier's paradise, Breckenridge is the fourth most expensive U.S. town with a median home value of $748,200, and nearly half of the homes are seasonal. Hood River, Oregon. This town sits at the crossing of the Columbia River Gorge and the Cascade Mountain Range. It is known as the windsurfing capital of the world. It's the fifth most expensive U.S. town with a median home value of $660,000. Next up is Haley, Idaho. This town sits in the central Idaho Rockies, straddling National Forest in the Wood River Valley. The median home value, $607,600. Next up, Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Here's another ski town, one that apparently doubles as a green mountain paradise in the warmer months. It is the seventh most expensive town with a median home value of $564,500. Port Townsend, Washington, located on the Olympic Peninsula. It offers Victorian charm with an urban vibe, according to their tourist site. One magazine called it the Paris of the Pacific Northwest. The median home cost $535,000. Ellensburg, Washington is located 2 hours from Seattle. It's set along the Yakima River. Ellensburg is both a college town and a rodeo town. It is the ninth most expensive town in the nation with a median home value of $497,400. And Los Alamos, New Mexico. Now, Los Alamos, which is located not far from Santa Fe, sits at the foot of the Pajarito Mountain in a land of canyons and mesas. It is best known, though, as the birthplace of the Manhattan Project. It ranks as the 10th most expensive U.S. town with a median home value of $495,800. So, you didn't see your favorite town in the top 10 listing? Well, it may lurk further down the list. Here's a few other notable towns that ranked among LendingTree's top 50 for median home value. Astoria, Oregon. This is Oregon's oldest city and the first permanent U.S. settlement west of the Rockies, according to a tourist site. It sits at the mouth of the Columbia River. Median home value is $468,300. Then there's Kill Devil Hills in North Carolina. Now surely the name alone would beckon visitors to Kill Devil Hills. It's a town on North Carolina's Outer Banks. It's a beach resort and the site of the inaugural human flight. Median home value is $460,400. Then there's Cody, Wyoming. This is the town founded by Colonel William Buffalo Bill Cody. It still offers rodeos and fake gunfights set amid authentic frontier storefronts. The median value there is $400,500. Then we have Taos, New Mexico. Taos is home to Taos Pueblo. It's a World Heritage Site, A plethora of galleries and museums abound. The median home value is $382,800. Crescent City, California. This coastal town, just south of the Oregon border, sits near lush redwood forest, and it boasts an 1856 lighthouse. The median home value is $342,000. Laramie, Wyoming. Now, Laramie is home to the University of Wyoming. It's also a magnet for outdoor enthusiasts, and the median home value there, $333,000. And finally, Bennington, Vermont, home to Bennington College. Bennington is tucked between the Taconic and Green Mountains. It was the site of a Revolutionary War battle, and it is a must-see for Donna Tartt Buffs. The median home value there, $279,900. And that was the article, Massachusetts Island Getaways Top the List of Expensive Towns. We just passed 16 minutes past the hour. Time for us to move on over to the sports section now. At the top of the front page of the sports section, there is a picture of Matt LaFleur and Mike LaFleur. And this was taken back in the 1900s when the two of them were in youth football. And so the picture's a little distorted, you know, but underneath it says, Brotherly Love, Cards Packers Meeting is Family Affair for LaFleur. It was written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. In two football offices across America, split by 1,500 miles that separates Tempe, Arizona from Green Bay, Wisconsin, there exist identical copies of a poster. At the center, a football coach is pictured commanding a pep rally sometime in the 1970s, his head shining bald and his face framed by a Fu Manchu mustache befitting the era. Around the edges, index cards depict pieces of the coach's playbook. When the coach, Bob Berenger, passed away in 2010, Brianne LaFleur, his granddaughter-in-law, crafted these posters, and they now hang in the offices of Matt LaFleur and Mike LaFleur, commemorating the legacy of a man whom Mike recently described as the rock of our family. And they explained, to a degree, how Matt and Mike have become head coaches of the Green Bay Packers and the Arizona Cardinals, 5 decades after their grandfather patrolled the halls of Lori Norick's High School back in Kalamazoo, Michigan. As kids, the boys, who were 7 years apart, were raised with football as the backdrop to their childhood. They watched their dad, Denny, arrive home late at night after long evenings at the Central Michigan facility where he spent decades as an assistant coach. They spent all week looking forward to Saturday afternoons when they would carry his cords on the sidelines, back when family members were allowed to do that. And they saw the dedication of their mom, Christy, who balanced the demands of motherhood with the responsibilities of being a teacher and coaching multiple sports at Mount Pleasant High School. Christy LaFleur told the Republic, quote, "When you've got educators as parents, you are going to work hard. And we never really had to get on them about it. I think they had enough respect for themselves that they wanted to do well." Unquote. Well, when the boys were young, Denny and Christy never pushed them into football. As kids, they alternated football practices with Little League baseball and recreational soccer games. In high school, fall football rolled into winter basketball, which became spring track. But really, football was inevitable. They saw it from their dad, and they heard stories from their grandfather, who drove up for every high school game and tried to do the same in college, even when his health began failing him. Christy said, "That's what these boys know, that your family is always there. They've carried it on just within themselves." That effect was more pronounced for Mike. when Matt became the starting quarterback at Mount Pleasant High, Mike was still in elementary school, the perfect age to view the high school players as heroes, and this entrenched football in his own future plans, even if his attempts to infiltrate Matt's friends group came with some brotherly scorn. Christie said, quote, Matt would get irritated with him, like, get out of here. He was a pest, Matt confirmed in a recent press conference. But that age gap, though, never prevented a close relationship between the brothers. Matt, Christie said, was always very protective of Mike, even then. And when Mike was a senior in high school, Matt accepted a graduate assistant role at Central Michigan, in part just to be in close proximity. Denny said, quote, they're not the same. You don't want them to be. But they had outgoing personalities. They were always doing the right things and had good friends, unquote. When asked what those differences were, even their parents had to do some searching. Eventually, Christie landed on an answer and said, quote, Mike is always smiling. He is a really, really happy kid. And Matt, sometimes, he would grumble a little bit. But really, to say that there is any significant differences, no. They came from our family dynamic, and they are a lot alike. Hence, they are doing the same thing. As they pursued that shared profession, their relationship only grew closer. Even now, with the demands of head coaching schedules, they talk 5 times a day, Mike estimates. And as a first-time head coach, that relationship is paying dividends. When Mike was hired by the Cardinals in February, most teams had already found partners for August joint practices. In that crowded landscape, Mike was able to call up his brother and settle on an agreement by the end of the day. And now that joint practice is here, followed by a preseason game at Lambeau Field on Saturday, August 29th. Now this one, Mike says, doesn't count toward the brothers' record against each other, which he proudly notes is 5-4 in his favor. Denny said, quote, it's probably for us a lot easier than most people think. But if it was a game that was during the season, then that would be a little stressful, unquote. Fortunately for all parties, no regular season games are scheduled between the teams until 2027. When Green Bay is set to visit Arizona. And that, everyone can acknowledge, will be a tense affair. Matt LaFleur said at his brother's introductory press conference, quote, my mom, she rarely watches the games. She just paces and tries to hide because of the stress. And Rams general manager Les Snead said, it's probably a good idea for your mom between September and January to move to Europe. So maybe we'll try to find a place for them over there. Well, good luck getting Christie on board. She and Denny have already planned out most of their fall schedule, with flights crisscrossing the country to watch both the Cardinals and the Packers in equal measure. Some weeks they've even managed to fit in 2 games, taking advantage of Green Bay's appearances on Thursday Night Football. And in 11 years into retirement, there are no plans to slow down. Christie says, quote, it's a blessing, I'll tell you. We certainly are very proud of what they have accomplished, and it happens to be that it's the NFL. But whatever it would have been, you are proud of your kids for putting in the work and being the best person they can be. And that was the article, Brotherly Love. Our second article from the front page of the sports section is right below that article at the top. This is about Diamondbacks baseball. Waldschmidt delivers walk-off bomb versus Cubs. It was written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic. Gabriel Moreno was describing the play. The way the ball he accidentally hit had rolled down the line, first looking like it would go foul, then fair, then foul again, before finally hitting the first base tag. And the entire time he could not stop smiling. He kept using the word crazy. He kept shaking his head, and he kept smiling. Moreno's good fortune helped the Diamondbacks pull off an improbable win. a night capped by Ryan Waldschmidt's pinch hit, walk-off, two-run home run in a 5-4 victory over the Chicago Cubs at Chase Field. It also might have changed the mojo around a team that had experienced quiet the past 8 days, starting with star Ketel Marte's no-show at Fenway Park in Boston. Manager Tory Lavullo said, quote, "We haven't had a lot of really positive momentum and good vibes. We've been dealing with some stuff. When the ball hit the bag, I thought, oh, there's a good little break right there." Well, the Diamondbacks needed it. When Moreno came to the plate with two on and two outs in the eighth inning, they were trailing 4-0. Now, a night earlier, they lost 7-0. Their rotation is in rough shape and likely will be for the next couple of weeks. And making things feel even worse on Tuesday was the fact that the pitcher who shut them out for the first 7 innings, that's right-hander Clay Holmes, was the same starter they thought they had acquired at the deadline before the New York Mets backed out of the deal. When Moreno's got a 2-2 slider up around his eyes from reliever Daniel Palencia, he was trying not to swing, but the ball cued off his bat and rolled down the line. For a moment, he did not leave the batter's box. Moreno said, "I looked, it was foul. Only then it wasn't." He said, "It was weird. It was right away a foul ball, and then it tried to come back, and then I thought it was going foul again, and then at the last second it came back and touched the base. It was crazy. Oh my God, that was crazy," unquote. The ball wound up scooting past first baseman Michael Busch and down the line into foul territory. A run scored, and Geraldo Perdomo followed by dumping a two-run single into center to make it a 4-3 game. An inning later, Lavullo sent Waldschmidt, a rookie, to the plate with a runner on against Cubs reliever Jacob Webb. Now, 6 weeks ago, Waldschmidt was brought back to the majors after a month-long stint in AAA Reno. His first go-round in the majors had not gone according to plan. He had racked up strikeouts and failed to provide impact. But his struggles, he said, had sent him into the wrong headspace. He wanted badly to produce. He was pressing, and it made things worse. He said, quote, "When you put that kind of pressure on yourself, it's hard to perform. Even if you do everything right, you get the right pitch, you make the right swing decision, if you're tense and you're amped up, you are not going to put yourself in the best position to be successful," unquote. Well, since coming back, he said he's played more freely, more like himself, and he has tried to take his at-bats without the burden of expectation. And that was the same approach he took with him to the plate in the ninth inning. And when Webb's left a 2-1 slider over the plate in the ninth inning, Waldschmidt did not try to do too much with it. He said, quote, "I just tried to stay through it, keep my head down, not try to get too big on that kind of pitch. If you try to do it, it usually doesn't happen," unquote. Well, the ball landed more than 10 rows deep in the left field bleachers, giving Waldschmidt his second walk-off home run this month after his August 7th blast against the Dodgers. Lavullo said he continues to step up in that big moment. He's got the right heartbeat, and that's not easy for a young player. Waldschmidt is hitting .296, .366, .449, with 6 doubles and 3 homers since being recalled on July 10th. Now, the Diamondbacks' 8th-inning rally started with a scary moment. With one out, Jordan Lawler was hit in the head by a Palencia fastball, a 98.4-mile-per-hour pitch that appeared to glance off Lawler's face guard as he tried to avoid it. Lawler was briefly motionless on the ground before eventually walking off the field. Lavullo said Lawler cleared concussion protocols and is penciled into the lineup for Wednesday, August 26th. Waldschmidt's shot gave the Diamondbacks their 40th comeback win of the season. They're tied for the most in the majors. Lavullo said, "These boys don't quit. These boys don't quit. They give you everything they've got every single night. Diamondbacks right-hander Corbin Burnes threw strikes, got a couple of outs, and then threw a little more in the bullpen. It was, he said, a good first step. He hopes that after one more, he might be ready to make his long-awaited return. Burnes pitched on Tuesday, August 25th, in a so-called bridge camp game at Sloan Park in Mesa, recording two outs and allowing a single against a lineup of Chicago Cubs minor leaguers. Pitching in the same game was Diamondbacks right-hander Zach Gallen, who gave up one run in three innings. Now, Burnes' fastball was mostly in the new low 90s, topping out at 93 miles per hour. He said, quote, "It was good. Came out, threw strikes, did what I needed to do. The misses we had were right around the zone. That was kind of my whole goal coming back, to make sure we're filling up the strike zone and being around it. Give ourselves a chance to get outs. From the look of it, the shapes, everything was pretty good there." Burnes' next outing could come on Saturday, August 29th, perhaps with AAA Reno, according to manager Tory Lavullo. Lavullo added that Burnes could pitch elsewhere in the minors due to wildfires in the Reno area. And after that, Burnes could be reinstated from the injured list, perhaps in Houston, for the Diamondback series there, September 4th, 5th, and 6th. After his outing on Tuesday, Burnes went to the bullpen and threw another 11 pitches, building his pitch count up to around 25. He threw there with less effort, he said, noting that the plan was to build the pitch count while limiting the intensity. Burnes was targeting a return from Tommy John surgery last July, but he had a setback due to a shoulder issue. His next outing in the majors will be his first since June 1, 2025. If he were to return in Houston, it likely would be a shortened outing. In that scenario, he would build his pitch count at the major league level rather than in the minors. Manager Lavullo said, quote, "We'll figure out what the next part of this puzzle looks like. Getting Corbin back at three innings and 45 pitches is the conversation. Is that going to be good for him? And is that going to be good for us? What does our bullpen look like at the time?" Burnes said, "I think it's going to depend on how everything goes in Reno. And if everything goes to plan, that might be. But obviously, there are some other higher-ups than me that make that decision. But my goal is to get back as quickly as I can. And today was a good step in that direction." Now, Gallen, who is also working his way back from an elbow issue, was primarily in that 93 to 94 mile per hour range with his fastball, and he threw 45 pitches. He said, "It was good. It was good to get the work in, just kind of progressing. I felt like the stuff was getting better as the outing went on. I feel like I'm in a good spot," unquote. Gallen's return from the injured list could come a little after Burnes, primarily because he isn't eligible to come off the 60-day list until September 7th, and Gallen was asked if he expects to be ready when eligible. And he said, quote, "I would like to be. It's an interesting kind of process we've gone through. We're just taking it day by day. I feel like I'm trending in a good spot. We'll see how I bounce back. I think that's been the biggest thing. Start to start, how I am bouncing back. I was pretty pleased with today," unquote. Lavullo said he apologized to Chicago Cubs manager Craig Counsell on Tuesday, a day after his club accused the Cubs of engaging in illegal sign stealing with right-hander Merrill Kelly on the mound. Lavullo got clarification from Major League Baseball and was told base coaches can do what they want so long as they are in the coaches' boxes in foul territory. Lavullo said he was under the impression that off-season rule changes made relaying signs illegal. Instead, only the requirement that coaches stay in their box changed. Lavullo said, quote, "Everything the Chicago Cubs were doing was perfectly legal and within the boundaries of the rules," unquote. In the fifth inning on Monday night, August 24th, Kelly stepped off the mound after he witnessed Cubs third base coach Quinton Berry relaying signs to a runner on second base every time Kelly was about to throw his changeup. Coaches on the Diamondbacks bench engaged in a screaming match with Cubs coaches in the opposite dugout. They also got into a back and forth with Barry, as did Kelly after he was removed from the game. Lavulo said, "Our main objective is Operation Protect Our House. That's all I care about. We've got to take care of our guys. So if there's a tell, we've got to see it. So we are constantly looking at our guys so we don't give away stuff. And we slipped. We got beat. Credit to the Cubs for being able to see that and decode us on the level they were. It wasn't an easy angle for the hitter to see, so therefore the base coach got involved, which is fine." Unquote. The Diamondbacks have already addressed it from Kelly's perspective to prevent it from happening again. Lavulo was asked if he might ask his coaches to start looking to relay similar information now that he is aware it is legal. And he said, "Yep, I think we're going to jump into that pond." And that was the article, Waldschmidt Delivers Walk-Off Bomb Versus the Cubs. Our third article from the front page of the sports section is about the Phoenix Mercury, the women's NBA. Plum makes home debut. This was written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. Nearly a month after being traded to Phoenix, Kelsey Plum made her home debut Tuesday, August 25th. Although Plum was warmly received, she turned the ball over on her first possession when she inbounded the ball off Mystics center Shakira Austin, and Lauren Betts stole the ball. Plum said she'd hoped she'd get the ball to bounce off Austin and return it for a shot. And Plum said, quote, "The ball didn't go the way I thought it would. It's kind of like the whole game, to be honest," unquote. Prior to Tuesday, Plum had played 4 games during the Mercury's road trip from August 3rd through the 9th before aggravating her left calf injury against the Mystics. In the lead-up to the game, she had practiced with the team a few times before being activated again. The 32-year-old guard played in 4-minute intervals and took some time to acclimate, but then found her chemistry with Alyssa Thomas, and she finished with 10 points on 4 of 12 shooting in 16 minutes. Coach Nate Tibbetts said, quote, "These are part of the steps, part of the progression. I thought in the second half she looked a lot more comfortable in those minutes, both for herself and with the team," unquote. Now the Phoenix Mercury couldn't do much on the defensive end to stop the Washington Mystics from rolling to a 94-84 win at the Mortgage Matchup Center. The two teams will face each other in the latter of the 2-game set on Thursday, August 27th in Phoenix. Tibbetts said, "We were soft on the ball. We weren't as competitive as they were on the ball, and they made it tough for us." The Mercury, who are 13 wins and 24 losses, were eliminated from the playoffs on August 22nd, but will use the remaining 7 games to determine what the team's future will look like. Mercury general manager Nick Urin has been adamant that Plum is part of his vision for the team if she signs with Phoenix in the offseason. Plum has had an uncharacteristic season, with injuries shortening it to 17 games. In her 5 games with the Mercury, she averaged 15.8 points and 2.8 assists. Plum said, quote, "Everyone has been playing a lot of basketball, and I've got some catching up to do. I've been working really hard to get ready for this moment, so if anything, I'm just going to enjoy it. It's been a tough season, but it's been a blessing to be able to play and to play here," unquote. The remaining 6 games on the Mercury schedule serve as an individual season to Plum, who is still learning the Mercury system with Thomas and Kalia Copper. The rotation was once again updated after Dawana Bonner took a contract buyout on August 24th. The Mercury returned to starting Natasha Mack at center, a position that she has started 20 games previously. Mack looked like the player she was before being injured in late June, being, quote, "everywhere all the time," unquote, and was limiting second-chance shots and finding open shots against a big and physical Mystics front court. Mack said, quote, "The last couple of games, I've been off, so I decided, what the heck, I might as well do what I can and hope for the best," unquote. Mack reached a career-high 19 points, matching Copper as the Mercury's top scorer. Her 9 field goals and 3 blocked shots led the team. Tibbetts said, quote, her conditioning was really good. The touch around the basket was great. I'm really happy for her that she came out and performed the way she did tonight against a really good team, unquote. The Mercury explored other post players, including Kiera Lynchkins, who hadn't played since August 9th, and Maddie Westbeld, who was acquired on August 18th. Westbeld didn't see as much time on the floor, as she's still learning the system, but she showed early promise in her matchup with Austin in the second quarter, where she forced a jump ball. The teams will face each other again on August 27th. In that one-day break, the Mercury will likely review the defensive lapses that caused Washington to shoot 9 three-pointers and out-rebound Phoenix by 9. And that's the article by Jenna Ortiz, Plum Makes Home Debut. The fourth article from the front page of the sports section is entitled Prayers Pour In for ASU Hockey's Mayich. This was written by Ray Covarrubias Jr. and Robert Anglin for the Arizona Republic. Prayers and support are pouring in for an Arizona State University hockey player who collapsed during an outdoor exercise at the school track on August 20th. Matthew Mayich, that's Mayich. He's 21. He remains hospitalized in Phoenix after suffering what was described as a possible cardiac event. ASU announced it was investigating an outdoor workout in which a member of the hockey team collapsed on August 23rd, and that's the last time the university has commented on the event. ASU has declined to identify the hockey player, citing privacy rules. Mayich suffered what was described as a possible cardiac event and was in a coma, according to a person close to the family. ASU was reviewing everything surrounding the workout at the school track, Chris Fiskus, who is Vice President of Media Relations, told the Arizona Republic. A virtual prayer service was shared on August 25th by the Canadian-Croatian Chamber of Commerce, which brought together supporters in Mayich's home province of Ontario and elsewhere. One of Mayich's relatives thanked those in the virtual room, which was packed with so many people that no more were able to join. Mayich's cousin, Victoria Berra, said, quote, even though we are going through this heartbreak, it is truly such a blessing to see everyone praying, and just the impact that Matthew has had on so many people. It's in God's hands. Please don't stop praying and don't give up. Berra is married to Owen Power, a Buffalo Sabres player in the NHL. Deacon Kevin Barron of the Catholic community of Buffalo North led the rosary. He said during the service, it's been a very faith-affirming process. Keep praying for Matthew. In an interview with the Arizona Republic after the service, Barron said he stepped in for the family to honor Mayich in a daily prayer session. He said, quote, I can see how important he is to both his family, the hockey community in Arizona State. It's been a beautiful, powerful, and spiritual experience, sort of honoring Matthew in this way and sort of praying for God's intercession. We are people that believe in prayer, unquote. August 25th marked the third consecutive day that Barron led a prayer service. He said it was a privilege to be able to help the family. He said that Mayich's family is grieving and asked for privacy and for the public's prayers. He said family members were not ready to address the public because they are struggling with the tragedy. Chris Fiskus, the Vice President of Media Relations, said on August 23rd, the university offers its support for the student-athlete, their family, and all our student-athletes during this difficult time. Tempe Fire Medical Rescue Crews responded at 8:30 a.m. on August 20th to ASU's Joe Sella Trek, located near Rural Road and Rio Salado Parkway, for calls of a heat-related illness. A person was treated and hospitalized, according to spokesperson Pat Shanahan. Now, Mayich is a sophomore defenseman from Stoney Creek, Ontario, Canada, near Hamilton. He's in his first year in the program after transferring from Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. He was part of a 2026 ASU transfer portal class that ranked first in the country. He appeared in 34 games, tallying 7 goals and 8 assists in his freshman season at Clarkson. Before playing at Clarkson, he spent 4 years with the Ottawa 67s of the Ontario Hockey League, appearing in more than 250 games, scoring 106 points over his career. He was selected by the St. Louis Blues in the 6th round of the 2023 NHL Draft. Now, the Phoenix area has been experiencing extreme heat for days. Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport recorded a temperature of 87 degrees at 7:51 a.m. and 89 degrees around 8:51 a.m. on August 20th, according to Iowa Environmental Messenet Weather Archives, which is part of Iowa State University. And that was the article, Prayers Pour In for ASU Hockey's Mayich. We are just past 46 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section and begin by reading today's horoscopes. We begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. A messy situation finally reveals its weak link. What fix would make the entire day run better? For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th. Eureka! You've got it! A brilliant idea could flash before your eyes today as Mercury meets the Virgo Sun. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, a private realization clicks into place today. You are putting the pieces of your past together into a neat little puzzle. For Cancer, June 22nd through July 22nd birth dates, busy, busy, busy. The day has plenty in store for you as Mercury meets the Virgo Sun, so sharpen your focus. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you getting a handle on money? Balance the books and see what you are working with as Mercury meets the Virgo Sun. And for you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, you are as clear as a bell today. Are you ready to say what you think out loud? Speak what is on your mind. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, it's a great day for meditation. A special message wants to come through as Mercury fuses with the Virgo Sun. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, friends are coming out of the woodwork today. With Mercury joining the Virgo Sun today, it brings support your way. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, do you need to pitch your work to the public? Well, get the word out as Mercury joins the Virgo Sun today. For Capricorns, December 22nd to January 19th birth dates, are you seeing the big picture in a practical light? You can put the pieces together today. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, read the fine print. Are you making sure an agreement has clear language before everyone moves forward? And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Get to the heart of the matter in a relationship. What needs to be said so that you are both clear? And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I got permission from my estranged brother to invite his 17-year-old daughter Ella to spend a month with my family this summer. We live on the East Coast, and she lives on the West Coast. Ella is about to graduate from high school and has had a difficult home life and relationship with her dad and stepmother. After making her travel arrangements, I came across recent social media posts that my niece wrote disparaging her father. Now, I'm in no position to discipline or judge her, but I felt that I had to say something so she knows that I don't condone what she has done. I'm now second-guessing whether it's a good idea to have Ella around my 13 and 9-year-old children this summer. I told her the following, quote, I hadn't seen your post about your father and stepmother. As a loving adult, I want you to know I think it's very inappropriate. These kinds of postings tend to reflect more about the person posting than the person the post is about. For your own good, you should know that you too may be judged for what you have done. If not now, possibly in the future when you least want or expect it, unquote. Ella didn't respond to me, and she continues to write more disrespectful posts. Should I say anything more? I don't think my brother knows about the post, though my niece complained online about his having hacked her accounts. Signed, Having Second Thoughts. And Abby responds, Dear Second Thoughts, I wish you had mentioned the reason for your estrangement from your brother. Contact him and ask if he is aware of the comments Ella has posted and continues to post. If he is unaware, you should alert him. The choice of whether to cancel your niece's visit is up to you. But from where I sit, she appears to be an unhappy girl who could use a break from Dad. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I'm a 63-year-old woman who retired about 8 years ago. I have decided to go back into the workforce. Nothing huge, just a job to enable me to keep up with rising costs and to set some money aside. My problem is that everyone wants you to apply online. I go online to look for work. I find something of interest. I click on it, and it takes me to a sign-in page for some sort of job site like Munster or Indeed. I fill out my information, and then I get a whole list of jobs, none of which are the one I originally clicked on. I've never had this much trouble finding a job. Any advice would be welcome. I'm running out of options. Signed, Willing to Work. Dear Willing to Work, applying through those online job sites can feel like talking to a wall. Since you're not looking for anything fancy, the old-fashioned approach may work better. Check the bulletin boards of community centers and senior centers and local colleges and libraries or similar establishments. When you're out and about, keep your eyes peeled for help wanted notices. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Remember, you can always contact her by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. And now let's take a look at some comics. In the first comic strip, Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood's at the barbershop, in the chair, getting his hair cut. There's a sign on the wall that says, Kids, half price. Dagwood says to the barber, I see you have a back-to-school special. And the barber says, Yep, I'm doing my part to encourage good grooming. There are a lot of wacky, offbeat hairstyles out there. And in the last frame, we see the parent pulling his and holding his kid's hand as they walk to the front door. And the bartender says, but enough about the parents, because it looks like the dad has a bald head and long flowing hair down to his shoulders, and it looks like the kid might have the same haircut. Anyway, that was Blondie. And then in Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, sorry that I cussed, Mom. And she says, I'm not surprised. And it looks like he's got his hand out. You know, she might be trimming his nails, his fingernails. In the second frame, she says, you're just like your dad. And then Jeremy says, oh, does he? In the third frame, he goes, ow, ow, ow. And she says, yeah, you're both big babies. So I guess that was... might have been, you know, digging a splinter out of his finger. I don't know. Couldn't see. Couldn't tell. And then in Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, the doctor is in the first frame, is all you see, and he says, you can't fit a square peg in a round hole. And then he points to Sergeant Snorkel in the second frame and he says, but you could try putting a square meal in that round belly. And Sergeant Snorkel says, ooh, like a tavern-style pizza? And that was Beetle Bailey. And in the comic strip Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, in the first frame, Nelson, the grandson, says to his grandma, what are you doing, Grandma? And she's looking down saying, well, I'm trying to make maybe a nice apricot scarf would tie it all together. And in the second frame, she says, I'm trying to figure out what to wear to book club tonight. I can't decide between the floral dress or the polka dot top and the pleated skirt. And Nelson looks down, and she's looking down, and Nelson says, won't Grandpa be mad? And she says, oh, I don't think so. And the last frame, she says, I'll put all these clothes away before he wakes up. And there's Grandpa on the couch, and he's got a pleated skirt laying on top, and then he's got a flowered blouse draped under his chin. So I guess she's trying out what her clothes look like on him. But he's asleep and he can't tell. And that was Pickles. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities today. The singer and actor Tommy Sands turns 89 today. Actor Harrison Page turns 85. The actress Tuesday Weld turns 83. Bassist Glenn Matlock with a group called Sex Pistols, he turns 70. Designer Tom Ford turns 65. VJ Downtown Julie Brown, she turns 63. And dog trainer Cesar Milan turns 57. Congratulations and happy birthday. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the Reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, August 27th, 2026. I hope you have a great day today. Bye-bye.